Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. Today's Tailwind Nutrition Trail Tip is by Barefoot Terry.
Well, in the words of Caballo Blanco, you know, run easy, light, smooth, and fast.
Yes.
And when you're running uphill, if it's going to take two steps, take three.
Ah.
Those long steps do take power, and squatting heavier weights,
shift into a higher gear.
The old mountain bike thing, right? Downshift and go. Keep the cadence high.
Thank you, Barefoot Cherry.
Thank you.
Are we recording?
I'm not nervous. I got this. Let's just do it.
And it was a miserable, miserable day.
You have a message from Freeman Dawn. Run, Moss.
Ashley, were you expecting a professional podcast?
No, I wasn't. Apparently not. Sorry, guys.
And action. Thanks for joining another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Scott War.
And I'm Don Freeman.
And Faith Goss is AOL.
Well, she's on her way. She's in traffic and trying to get here. She's saving people's
lives. She's running. She's not in traffic.
Yeah,
she's on
running,
a trail
yeah.
run.
That's right. So, Scott,
yeah,
we're here today to talk a little bit about trail culture.
Seems fitting since this is what number podcast for us?
This is number 100. If you're counting. And, you know, I don't know. 100 seems to be big in our sport, right? There's 100K. There's the illustrious 100 mile. I'm starting to think we should get a belt buckle or a cupcake or something.
This is our century podcast.
There are songs about this. I think 100 beers on the wall.
Shall we sing it?
Shall we take one
100,
down?
100 podcasts.
Take all 100 down.
That could fill up the hour, yeah.
We're going to introduce our guests here so we can identify who these people are helping us.
We thought since this was our big 100, we should make it a special podcast.
And they're all special,
and
Scott.
Tell the nation how you came up with this idea.
So who didn't agree to come and that you put us on instead?
Well, good. Let me share with you how Bob came along on Bob Crowley onto the podcast. As I was running behind a gentleman who was wearing some Hokas, who I could see was a seasoned trail runner. And then as I got closer, I recognized, well, that's Bob Crowley. And he is well known in our area as just a great ambassador of the trail, there to help people learn and to teach people how to enjoy the sport. And in fact, is a race director himself, along with our other guests back east. So I started talking to Bob, and we started to talk about trail culture and how wonderful our community is. And when you're running 50 miles, you've got time to talk. And we really just started to identify, hey, you know, this culture is a fantastic culture, and popularity of our sport is building. Is there a risk at that? Is there a risk of losing our culture within what we recognize to be such a great environment? And so that's where the conversation went. But before we get into that completely, Scott, let's talk about Bob and Josh.
Right. Well, I was going to say, you know, Bob is well qualified to understand a little bit more about the history of this sport and the culture of this sport. According to Ultra Sign Up, you started running races in 92.
So you're just basically saying because I'm old, I'm qualified.
No, seasoned and wise.
Seasoned and wise. Heavy on the season. That's twice that's been used already.
It's two seasons?
Yeah.
Okay, well, take that off
so,
the list.
So, you know, since 92 he's been in the sport, and I was just looking at some of his results. Not only has he been running that long, but I looked at one of his first Way Too Cool finishes, and I saw one of his most recent Way Too Cool finishes, and he has increased his time, or let me see, decreased his time, mm-hmm. bettered his time by over an hour over these many years. So he's getting faster. How does that work, Bob?
I think it...
Shortcuts?
I don't think
Are you finding
work.
Shortcuts on the
yeah.
trail?
Yeah, I think Julie has been giving me all the tips on where to go left and right, avoid the traffic, and cut a few miles off.
So more than just 50Ks, Bob's been out there on some 50-mile runs, American River 50.
He's run Western States.
He's run Western States, and he has run and will run again this year, Hard Rock.
Ooh,
and so
that's a tough race.
That is a race of a, I'm not going to say seasoned, but you need to be experienced. You need to know the sport and your body well to manage that kind of course.
And lucky to get in.
After the podcast, let's talk about how you got in 2 years in a row. That's what I want to know.
Now, Josh, on the other hand, we'll have Bob introduce Josh a little bit. But Josh, on the other hand, gives us a little bit different perspective. You know, Bob said that you've been in the sport for relatively few years, since 2007?
Right around there. I think that was my first ultra, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, 2007.
And what Josh has going for him is not only is he new, but he's freaking fast.
Mm-hmm.
According to Ultra Sign Up, he has 10 first place finishes.
Oh, okay.
So he's a fast guy.
Mm-hmm.
So now we have some seasoned longevity in the sport and someone relatively new to the sport.
So perspective is what we're talking about.
We are.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Josh is tall, young, good looking, and fast.
Yeah.
I'm bald. Kind of heavy, incredibly slow.
How are you heavy?
And that's
but I fit into the Yeti suit better, Bob.
And that's the ballast. Yeah, yeah. We both fit into the Yeti suit, just not at the same time.
So tell us how you got to know Josh and your relationship, and why you recommended that he come on this podcast.
So Josh and I met in our trail running club back in New England called the Trail Animals Running Club. So it's been around since the mid-90s, and was about 15, 20 members at the time, and mostly just trying to find folks that would run long runs together. And it had an eclectic membership back then, from folks in California. I think Carl and Ann were, Ann Trayson were members at one point, and a number of New England folks. And then as we got older and had kids and kind of retired from ultra running for a while, we mothballed it and then brought it back in 2007. Again, all of us, three of us wanting to train for Western, and they had the buddy system back then, so you'd put in, two guys would put in together. If one got in, the other would get in. And started putting in, didn't get in, and along the way wanted to have some friends to train with. So we put up a website. At the last time we had the club, there was no internet. It was newsletters. And didn't really think much of it. If we got four or five people to respond, that would be great. And we did, and had company and trained with a dozen people, three core folks, myself included. And one thing led to another, and within a year, we had 100 members. And within 2 years, we had over 1,000, and now into our fifth year, we have 2,500 and climbing members in the club. And one of those people along the way was Josh, who ran our oldest race called Don't Run Boston 50K. It was back when we thought the Boston Marathon was kind of commercial. And so this was an alternative run on the day before, and a number of the members would run the 50K and then turn around the next day and run the Boston Marathon. So Josh not only came into that race, he had run the Fells race before that, but he ran DRB, hardly no one knew who he was, and he not only won it, but he broke the course record, which had stood for a number of years. And at that point, we took notice. And one thing led to another, and Josh and I began to get to know each other and talk for hours about culture. And, we have a difference of age of Josh, I don't know, it must be 20-plus years. So, very different.
Somewhere around there.
Very different perspectives. And Josh, really had a new person to the sports perspective, and mine was a little bit more, from the 90s, and I wasn't there in the beginning, but certainly was brought up by some of the folks that have been on your previous podcast, the Guards and Steve Harrells and
right.
the world. And it was a really interesting perspective from Josh, why are you in the sport, et cetera, which I'm sure he'll explain. So that led to us talking about culture and talking about how it might get diluted. And we looked at other sports. In my business, I'm in investing, and so one of the things we get to do is look at all different sports and trends and look out over 30 years how they grow or decline. And I was predicting at the time that trail running was going to grow significantly, which it is, as we all know, double-digit growth. And ultra running may grow with it. And, of course, it has. And what would that mean to the sport? What would it mean to the sort of small community and the more intimacy that we've all experienced? Could it get diluted? Could it change so significantly that it would turn people off that maybe are veterans of the sport? Could the new folks come in, change the culture so much that it would really lose, you know, what is at the core? And Josh and I thought about ways in which we could harness the club and try to express not just how to run physically or prepare mentally or, you know, eat nutritionally, but the fourth aspect, which is to how to teach the culture. And something that doesn't get written about or blogged about nearly as much as the other three topics. And we thought that doing races that were approachable and accessible, and that meant inexpensive, and easy to get to, and not too hard, but challenging for the veterans, but easy enough that new people could do it, and then create a friendly, welcoming, you know, attitude and environment, all would help people through actual doing it, show them what it's like. And hopefully in being exposed to that would then turn around to the other members and say, this is cool, come join us. And it would take on a life of its own. So that was the premise, and all and Josh and I really got to know each other and started to design the system, the trail series, and let him pick it up from there in terms of, you know, where that went.
I'd like to jump in and ask if it's all right, Josh, what attracted you to the sport initially when you're looking from the outside? And I don't know what sport you were involved with before, if it was, you know, racquetball or maybe you were running on a track, but as you looked over and met Bob and the community, what's the first thing that you saw that made you say, I want to be one of these trail runners?
Right. Well, and I was a competitive tennis player all through college and you know, had illusions of turning pro there. But after college, you know, sort of stepped aside from that, and running became my way to just sort of maintain any sort of random sense of fitness. And so, you know, I was just running 2-3 miles a day, and then my wife and I moved back up here to Massachusetts, where she's from. And it was sort of the era, like 2006-2007, when ultra running blogs sort of were starting off, and I heard about DRB, Don't Run Boston, and I'd never run any sort of official race or anything. And and you know, the sort of the way DRB was billed is, you know, it's an unmarked course through the woods, and you basically run it with someone who knows it. And I was just like, well, you know, that kind of sounds intriguing, and yeah, I like the idea of doing something a little bit different than normal at that point. And then yeah, show up some Sunday morning in a reservation outside of Massachusetts, and there Bob and a bunch of other guys, and this is the first group of people who I'd ever met who instead of talking about a marathon were talking about their 100-mile training, and mm-hmm. thought nothing of it. And you know, you hear people saying, wow, I'm running, you know, a 100-miler in June, and then I'm thinking about doing another one in September. And all of a sudden you're sort of impressed, and you're like, I want to be someone who says, yeah, I can run 100 miles. And so I was sort of drawn just by that sense. They thought nothing of it. And it wasn't like they were bragging or anything, but it was just like, hey, this is what we're doing, 'cause we want to see if we can. And that sense of sort of personal challenge, I think, really drew me in. And especially the way that guys like Bob were sort of in a sense selling it, you know, just not as something extraordinary, but as something challenging, as something meaningful, and as something, you know, that you do with the people around you. You know, I think most of us would agree you don't run 100 miles by yourself, even if all your training runs are solo and everything. Come race day, you sort of feed off the people around you. And I was just, it's very compelling to be around people who think like that. And that sucked me in.
Hey Josh, I'm right there with you. I didn't start trail running hearing about the 100 mile first. I was out on the trail and then heard people talking about the 100 mile. And I was impressed to the point of almost like I was looking at a superhero of some kind. When I'm running next to someone that said, yeah, I run 100 miles, and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, this person ran 100 miles. And I was just so flabbergasted that, one, I was running next to somebody that could do it. And I thought, well, if I'm running next to him, maybe there's a chance that maybe I could do it because I'm running right with them, even though it was like mile 10, right?
No, exactly.
But I just felt empowered. I thought, wow, maybe I could even do that.
Well, and I think, too, what Josh said hits one of the points or traits of this culture is when you do hear about it from these people, it's not in a bragging sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
You never hear a ultra runner brag about their accomplishments. It comes up kind of in a nonchalant way. And then the other thing is, I mean, you could easily bump into somebody that is very well seasoned and an icon in the sport, and they're willing to just run with you.
Mm-hmm.
There's no cliques or arrogance about the sport, and that I think that's what drew me into it, and that people are so willing to share their experience versus holding that experience tight to their chest and using that as some kind of an advantage over the rest of the world.
So, Bob,
absolutely. I mean, just to sort of second that, I was, I ran in Western last year, and we stayed with Bob, but in Squaw, I was, and there's AJW and Tweet and all these other guys who are essentially like movie stars to me, and both of them, I had questions for them the day before the race, and both of them were more than happy to be like, oh yeah, try this. This is what's worked for me. It was incredible.
To that point, exactly. I was at one of the lotteries. This is a few years back. And there was a gentleman that had come all the way back from New York to participate in the lottery. I mean, it happened to work out for business. And so he stayed over the weekend. And then I'm talking to him, and he looks over, and to the right, he says, oh my goodness, there's Tim Tweetmeyer. And he looks over and he says, and there's Gordy Ainsley. And to us in our community, because they're so approachable, and we recognize their accomplishments and who they are. There's no doubt about it. They're, walking, running legends around here too, but so humble and approachable. And that's what makes it, of course, it makes running pretty cool.
And in reality, if you called Gordy up and said, hey, Gordy, can I join you on your next run? He would welcome it. He'd say, come on,
if you can keep up. So, Bob, have you seen some changes? You started running, certainly your first race was in 92. That doesn't mean that you were out on the trails before 92, because you just don't wake up one morning and go sign up for a race, unless your friend does that to you. And so have you seen some changes, or what looks to be changes, or are we preserving our culture? What are your thoughts?
Well, obviously the biggest change are the number of people participating. So we have had an opportunity in my business to study the growth of running in general, and then specifically trail running, and then the subcategory of ultra running. And it is double-digit growth year over year. And a lot of folks ask, when is the running boom going to kind of reach its peak? And my own personal view, and it may be contrary to many, is I actually think trail running will continue to grow considerably faster than road running. Mm-hmm. But I actually think we're reaching a peak for ultra running. And the reason is similar to what happened with mountain biking, where, ultra running's hard.
Yeah, it is.
And it's time consuming. And so what we have is an influx of folks coming from the road, trying trails, and they love it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get around ultra runners interspersed in that group and hear, just as Josh did, wow, what a incredible accomplishment. I wonder if I could do that. And they'll look at a 50K or any ultra distance, 50 miler, even 100 miler, and say, yeah, I wonder if I could do that. I've run a marathon. I bet I could.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a lot of folks that have it on their list to do, to try. And they'll do an ultra, maybe a 50K, 50-miler, and some of them will even go on and try to do a 100-miler. But the purpose of them doing it is to accomplish it, check the box, and then kind of move on to something else. And I'm not saying that's wrong. It's just that's what they're on a mission to do, is a bunch of different things in their life, which includes, you know, maybe finishing an ultra or two. Ultra runners, I think, are a little different in the sense that they're in it for good, mm-hmm. for the community, mm-hmm. and understand that there are many aspects of the community that that they really enjoy. And so they're not necessarily in it to just accomplish a particular goal, but they're in it because the community around them embraces them, and they embrace it back, and they get so much more out of it than just, you know, the ability to say I finished this or I got a PR. And I do think that we're going to go through a lot of folks in a lot of volume that achieve their goal, and then they'll stay trail runners. I do think that they'll enjoy that
on the recreational side.
Absolutely. Yeah, but I'm not sure that they're going to continue to have the time or the energy or the desire to do another 50 and another 100 or another 50K. I think they'll move on, and that's why I think you'll start to see the preponderance of number of races, new races, and selling out quickly. I think you're actually in the next few years going to see that back off. I really do. I may be completely wrong. Yeah, I usually am, but that's my prediction, is that we're very close to the peak.
Hmm. So give us an example. I mean, you studied some of these other sports. Can you give us an example of some sports that are similar? You mentioned mountain biking, where the culture has changed with the increase in numbers. And how did it change? Yeah. Or how do you think it changed?
Well, certainly, I'm no expert on, you know, these topics other than from an investment standpoint. We're interested in growth and what the drivers are. And so in studying different sports for that purpose, ask a lot of people that were there early in from soccer to, you know, baseball.
Triathlon
mm-hmm. for sure, and cycling. And one person that's a local friend and longtime colleague, Sally Edwards, mm-hmm. who was at triathlons at the very beginning and frankly, very early in ultra running. I asked Sally a number of months ago, what was it like in the beginning of cycling, for instance, and what was it like in triathlons? And the reason being is I'm interested in what's going to happen to ultra running, mm-hmm, potentially mm-hmm. based upon history. And it was a pretty consistent viewpoint from her that, you know, in the beginning, we'll speak to triathlons, it was a very close-knit group of people that kind of all knew each other and shared training techniques and equipment. And then as more and more people came into the sport, it became more competitive, for sure, better and better athletes. And I asked why more people came into the sport. She said it was money. Mm-hmm. So money drew better athletes, and they were able to make it a living.
Prize money.
Prize money.
Corporate sponsorship?
Both, yes. And so that brought better talent, mm-hmm. and it also brought a level of competition where folks weren't as apt to share. Hmm. They needed to, you know, develop their own technique and then win. And win why? Because they both got the credit but also the money. And I, again, I'm not criticizing, I'm just observing. So as a result of that, more and more you know, where there's money, there's more people. Where there's more people, there's more money, and it builds. And along the way, she felt, you know, organizationally, it kind of got out of hand. It one thing led to another, and then the Ironman franchise kind of stepped in and, of course, has been on a remarkable run for many, many decades now. And it got out of the hands of the people that originally had conceived and nurtured triathlons, to the point where the culture got, if you will, run over by all the popularity. And she likened the beginning of cycling to that as well. And again, the common thread was when prize money began to enter in and sponsorships, you got the benefit of the better athletes, but you also had the yin and the yang on that, which is people become more and more serious. And so the emphasis on culture and community is subordinated by the need to win. And they don't necessarily cohabitate well together. And so those are a couple of sports, cycling, triathlons, where it didn't, one thing led to another. We started out the same as ultra running. Mm-hmm. And there was a fairly dramatic change, got out of hand, and ultimately, you know, it is what it is today. Like it or not, it has its own culture. Ultra running, I still think, has preserved most of what was the origins, but it has certainly a risk at losing sight of why many people got into ultra running and stay in it, if there isn't an effort to, you know, like this podcast and others, to make sure that folks understand that other than, you know, learning how to run in an ultra, learning how to eat and have nutrition, and of course the mental preparation, there is that fourth aspect, and it's the one we hear least about in podcasts or blogs. You know, it's the one, and we use, Josh and I use the word tribal all the time. Mm-hmm. It's the thing you learn on the trail. It's the thing you have to see it in action and see other people doing what we're going to talk about
and feel it
and then turn around and not only do it themselves but share it with 10 other people,
right? Mm-hmm.
And spread it so that it becomes the norm, that becomes what is accepted, and what is unacceptable is the other kind of behavior. And you know, that's how cultures start, and that's how you preserve them. And if you lose that, as we saw in many cultures around the world in history, if it isn't repeated, if it isn't practiced, then it dies.
So here I have two questions from that. Number one, to Bob, and then one to Josh.
You only get one question at a time, Scott.
No,
I've got questions.
I'm putting my two questions on
okay.
the table.
All right.
The first one.
He's got pen in hand.
That's right.
Yeah, I've been making yeah. notes. The first one to Bob is the common thread of triathlons and cycling was the bigger corporate sponsorship. From your frame of mind or your perspective as an investor, do you think that ultra running is going to get that kind of financial backing as far as, you know, purses at races or that level of sponsorship?
Are we a big enough market
right.
to persuade corporate America to look at us?
Exactly.
My own personal opinion, no. It's too much of a niche.
Okay.
And it's too hard to cover. If you think the big money...
Exactly.
Tim Tweetmeyer and I were sitting around at a race last year around the campfire one night talking about this very thing. And, the big money where these sports really take off is when you get television coverage.
Mm-hmm. And if you remember back in the early days, I can't remember what years, ABC Wide World of Sports covered or tried to cover Western States a couple times.
That's right.
In Leadville, yeah. I believe, with Ann Trason running. They had.
Yeah.
I saw some old video back VHS.
But they what we found what I heard was is the
not that Ann's old.
The expense of covering a race and the logistics of covering a long race like that is very expensive.
Well,
and so it wasn't,
that's right. Yeah. So if you believe the premise that the big money really comes from media and specifically mm-hmm. television, then you have to ask yourself: is ultra running really conducive to that? Well, it's not a really good spectator sport. It's not.
Unless you know the runner.
It's very hard to film, to your point, Scott, and very expensive. And so those two factors alone lead to a kind of a huge expense. And then the audience itself, well, here's where it teeters on the possibilities because of the attention the sport has garnered through a number of the books mm-hmm. that we all mm-hmm. know have come out, and that has brought it mainstream to the front of consciousness of folks, and it's a curiosity. Mm-hmm. It's a good story, for sure. It's also a curious story. And I think that that's great. And I'm not sure whether it's something that people want to learn a lot about, but they're curious, they learn about it, and they move on. If folks really become so intrigued with it that it's something they need to know more and more about, then there's a possibility that based upon that premise, someone in the media might pick it up and say, I think I could run with this for a while. And you might see a little bit of a spike. My own personal perspective from an investor standpoint, I think it's way too niche and a little bit off the beaten path enough to drive the kind of audiences to sustain that kind of investment. So, you know, might there be a particular opportunity or two? Sure. But I don't see that as a ongoing, viable.
Can we delineate between trail running and then running in general, the 5K, 10K, 13.1, the half marathon crowds just growing? My mom just ran at 70 years old. She doesn't mind me telling her age because, you know, she's age grouping it out there. just ran a 13.1, her first half marathon, and then the marathon distance. Is there a difference between these two sports and the growth and the recognition and potentially the corporate, investment? And Josh, we don't want to leave you out of this, so jump in anytime.
I have a great question for Josh.
Good.
But after this. But all right. I would comment on that. There's definitely a difference between the two. I think culturally, there's a huge difference.
Oh, yeah.
I think definitely just, someone who started, I started my running career on a treadmill. And
that's a culture in itself.
I was happy to do it. Two miles a day after work every day. But, as you start running, the marathon is the be all end all. And I think that's part of what drew me into ultras is, all of a sudden, cause I think, as a culture, as an American culture, we think 26.2 is the finite distance a person can cover. And then you hear people covering 100 miles and you're you're flabbergasted. And I think there is something very distinct. Even my colleagues at work who know I go and do these things and show up in with crutches after some of the longer races, they can't even fathom that I do this, and they see me doing it every day. So I think there is something culturally that delineates between the 26.2 and then especially I see this shift a little bit in the 50K now. I Bob and I in our races, I think we have 50Ks, we have 2, 3 50Ks over the year, and we're starting to see a lot of people jumping into the 50K. And so I think there's a big change with that, but still I think the 50 mile, the 100 mile, 100K just sort of seem almost inaccessible to people.
So here's my question for you, Josh, and to expose my experience. I think I probably started running around the same time you did, so I'm fairly new to the sport too. My question to you is, when you decided to come into the sport, did you adapt to the culture, or were you a match to the culture? Did it match who you were and how you believed things, or did you adapt?
Good question, Scott. That was my question, actually. I had that in my head.
I stole it.
That's a great question.
I wrote it down.
Well, you're making me think about this. This is way past my bedtime here on the East Coast. Now I got to think. I think for me, personally, I've always sort of been a rather introverted person by nature. And I think running, trail running, and the idea of ultras sort of lends itself to that. Because you obviously spend a lot of time in your own head and by yourself, even when you're running with other people. But I think what and my wife would actually probably attest to this, what's kept me in it and actually, just has really sparked my interest in it is this sense, and I suppose it's the sense that it is something that draws me to it. So I guess in that sense, I have adapted in a way. But I think you get a lot of similar similar personalities, and because of the welcoming nature of it, it's very easy for someone like me who tends to be a little more reserved socially and whatnot to feel very comfortable in this setting. And so adapting in that sense, like I there's no other sort of social group that I spend so much time with in my personal life. And so I feel like it's very easy to jump into this social group. But it is adapting in the sense, like, it's forcing me to, or not forcing, but I'm happy to join it. But in that sense, I haven't felt like I've had to greatly alter who I am, how I act in any of these settings, if that makes any sort of sense.
Yeah. You know, Scott, that's such a great question that I think that we should just kind of throw that around the table here. And I'd like to go next so that I don't have to worry about you taking my comment. And it's this, that when I, you know, was introduced to the community, I felt comfortable in it. And I said, yeah, I like these people. Had I gone to, and I've thrown this out here, there before, like a quilting group, I would have looked around the quilting group and said, these aren't my people. You know, I feel a little bit uncomfortable here. There's not a lot going on here. I might go stand in the lobby and see what's in the vending machine or something. Count the parking lot stalls. I'll do something, but probably not hang out with this group. But with the trail community, it was easy talking to people, and we had similar values and goals, and this positive energy seemed to flow around the group. So as far as adapting, I think I became the guy that said, okay, what do I need to wear? How do I need to act? How to make sure that I fit in? Should I wear a bandana around my head? You know, do the glasses go on top of my head even if I'm not going to wear them? I mean, what are the things that I need to do to look like a trail runner so that they'll accept me and know that I'm one of them?
You know, and interestingly enough, Don and I have been on runs before where we'll be running and running through the paved streets of a small city that we next to the trail.
We're not supposed to talk about that part of the run.
and
Roadrunner Nation.
And we will be running through and we'll see another runner coming down the street, and you can pick them out like a sore thumb.
A mile away.
They're not a trail runner. They're a road runner. And so you're right. You need to be you need to dress the part.
And some guys are late for a bus.
They're running in their suit.
Yes. But they're that easy to spot, Scott.
Well, you know, one of the things that, you know, I got into it, we've talked about that, but anyway, I eventually got into it. But the thing that I think that I matched the community because I grew up in Wyoming where there's not a lot of people and there's a lot of outdoors. And I love to be outdoors, and I've always wanted to be outdoors and recreate outdoors. And being in the mountains and on the trails matched who I was. And so that part of it was definitely a match. I think the things, and I'll ask that after you say your bit, Bob.
You know, for me, as I recall, it really was a feeling of being at home. So I was exposed to actually trail running through a sport called Ride and Tie.
Mm, yeah,
yep, so, we've heard about that.
Frank Lieberman.
A number of ultra runners also ride and tie. Jim Howard and Tom mm-hmm. Johnson and mm. Dan Barger and
big names. You know, Gordy Ainsley, right?
Gordy Ainsley, a whole bunch mm-hmm. of yeah. folks. And but I you perform ride and tie. It's a horse and two runners, and you take turns riding the horse and running. And it's done in the mountains and, you know, on the trail. So that was, we had a train. Together, all three of us, and that was my first exposure to trail running, and that felt, I certainly had trail run a little bit, but very little more trail riding, and in fact, met my wife over horseback riding, and she was an instructor and taught me how to ride, and so that felt natural. The idea of me getting off the horse and running on the trail was a little new, but it felt great. So once I got exposed to that and then began to discover there were people that just ran on the trail all the time, was invited into that community. And I remember thinking, coming home, two things. One is, these people are nuts. And it felt really like home to me. And it was the first it was just being on the trails and being out there was what felt at home. And then obviously the more I got exposed to the community, to both of your experiences and Josh, I was drawn into it. I found, you know, the very interesting people, and they were willing to teach and willing to mentor. And I was like a sponge. I couldn't get enough information. And the more you went out, the more you learned. And before you knew it, it was sort of an unconscious giving over, very religious sort of, you know, you just this unconscious giving. And then next thing you know, you wake up one day and they're talking you into doing your first ultra, which is, as Josh said, you know, beyond anything that you thought you could do. And they're treating it as if it's just a, you know, a little walk down the street, and then it starts. And I think so. For me, I actually think it became familiar. It became very familiar for me first, and then I kind of got drawn in.
Okay, so along what you said there, Bob, the question I wanted round table again, have everybody input on, is what is the one, just one thing that you learned from another trail runner that you had to adapt to become a trail runner? Does that make sense?
It does, but I'm not smart enough to come up with it this quick. Do you have one to get us started?
I'll tell you right away. I remember the first trail run that I did with our common friend. He said, come on, we're going to go up to Auburn Lakes Trail, which is part, you know, you go through there on Western States Trail. He says, come on up, we'll go on a trail run. I go, okay. I had no idea. I didn't say, what should I bring or anything like that. So I show up there in my basketball, knee-length basketball shorts. I had a pair of road running shoes, which I actually enjoyed for probably 2 or 3 years. I didn't get a pair of trail running shoes until much later. And I had like an Aquafina, just a regular water bottle. And he looked at me and he said, oh, that's not going to do. And of course, he didn't have any extra water bottle holders. But you know, that's the thing. My thing is the water bottle holders. He says, you got to take water, and you can't, you're not going to have the grip for as long as we're going to be out there to hold on to these things. You need to somehow be able to handle these things. And first thing I did when I got back is I went to the running store and bought a couple water bottle holders.
It's fun to go shopping.
Yeah. So that was part of the culture that I learned.
You know, and I'll pick up on it. So you guys, if you need more time,
start thinking.
Yeah, you can think. But, you know, I remember that, well, it's going to be raining out there. You know, we better get some. We didn't know, Bob. We hadn't met you yet. You hadn't told us this stuff. And so,
where were you, Bob?
Yeah.
Way to leave us hanging.
So we're looking through the catalogs and we go, oh, roadrunner.com or something. They have rain gear. I mean, they're slickers, right? I mean, they're plastic suits, but it, you know, for running. Okay, good. So we get those, and we're out there running. And out here in Northern California, it's actually warmer when it rains than when it's not raining, you know, in the wintertime. You know, if it's raining in the winter, the temperatures aren't quite as cold as if it's not raining. And so we're in this suit, and it's like a sauna in these suits.
Does this take you back to wrestling when you had to drop weight in one of those rubber suits?
We were dropping weight fast. and so we ended up hiding those slickers underneath a rock and probably in some poison oak because we didn't even know what we were looking at.
Did you go back and get them?
No, I still have it at home. And they were expensive. They're like $110 for these outfits. And what we did was observe other runners that were out there. And we're so naive, and we said, look, he's just wearing a pair of shorts, and he has a very light shell jacket, and that's it. And that guy, all he's wearing is just a regular tech T-shirt. And we learned just from observing, but how far away we were from the knowledge base. You know, we just didn't know, and we just learned from watching people. And on our own accord, we were buying $110 suits and zipping up and, you know, putting plastic bags over our hands. I mean, we didn't do that. But stuff like that, it's just ridiculous. We really need to teach one another, that's for sure.
Yeah, so
yeah, I think...
Go ahead,
Josh. I definitely think it's, you know, there is this sort of technical aspect of it as well. And hearing you guys talk about that, I'm sort of thinking, Oh, yeah. Like, I remember when I bought my first handheld water bottle, and then my first, you know, but that was after I bought my waste pack, and I didn't like the waste pack so much.
We all had one of those, didn't we? Who would ever think that you could use one of those? Yeah, I'll fill 15 of these little water bottles. I have the opening of a penny size opening. Yeah, that's going to work.
Oh, I have the drawer, and you know that you open it, and it just spills water bottles and all these old versions of it and stuff. But I think for me, sort of coming from a sport, from tennis, and a competitive background where you know that it was all about competition and about can you beat this other person, even on my team, and you know we were very supportive of each other on the team, but it was very much. Like, you know, even can I move up the ladder and beat this guy who's ahead of me on the team so I can play a higher number, and can I beat this guy who's from this other team? For me, it was almost like adapting the mental aspect to it. Because I remember when I had my first successful race, it was a 40 miler right up the road for me, and I took the early start because I had no sense how I was going to do, and I was convinced I was going to blow up and fall apart, and I ended up winning it, and I remember, you know, sort of this expectation that I would be showered with praise and adoration from millions of fans, and you know it's you sort of get this you get this realization that it's not about sort of the individual accomplishment, but it's about sort of the collective accomplishment. And so now, you know, I find like some of the greatest joys I get out of this sport are hanging around at the finish line, and now people who I'm good friends with, I'm watching them come in and helping at the aid station and filling up water bottles for people. And just this sort of mental adaptation to, it's not about my own personal success, but it's about sort of this incredible spirit and that positive vibe and energy that we get from each other, and sort of really actually just sharing this experience, and so shifting that and realizing that, yeah, you know, it's not about all the individual praise on you, but it's saying, wow, look at what we did today. And that I feel like was sort of a bit of a switch I had to make mentally as I got into this.
You know, it reminds me of the urban legend, and Don, you were around in the sport, and Bob, you could probably attest to this. I heard that, you know, in the heyday of Scott Jurek, that he would win Western States and then put a sleeping bag around him and wait until every runner came through the finish line. And I think that's what you're saying, Josh. I mean, here is this guy that's won Western States a gazillion times, and his thrill of not just winning the race, he gets a thrill out of watching that person come in just under the 24-hour cutoff or just under the 30-hour cutoff.
Yeah.
That I think that's impressive.
Well, and that's actually, I think my greatest memory from Western last year, and I've told Bob this and a bunch of people, was at the award ceremony. And you know, you have guys who just run under 15 hours, and then you have people who just finished, you know, a few minutes ago, and and it's, you know, it's this incredible thing, because it's not, it really is, I felt this great sense that it wasn't about any individual accomplishment, but it was like, hey, look at this experience we've all just shared here. And to me, that was the memory from Western and from these races that Bob and I have been putting on that I hope to bring with me when I'm senile and my kids are trying to stick me in a home, you know. That's what I want to remember if I can.
You know, we've been fortunate doing this podcast to interview some pretty elite runners that have, you know, you would think are unapproachable or really, you know, they're elite runners. And we've talked to them on the air and off the air, and they're as impressed with the person that does a 30-hour finish at one of these events
when they're running sub 15, they're saying, I don't know if I could be out there for 30 hours doing this. And they're as in awe as we are at them running that fast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's, yeah. And that I think is one of the great things about this is, I think, you know, the people who, as Bob was saying, sort of get this sport are the people who appreciate that everyone's accomplishment is pretty darn amazing, no matter what.
So can I hijack for a second?
Absolutely.
On culture specifically. So I've had the privilege of running amongst the wonderful Northern California ultra community for many, many years, and also having lived in Boston and still have a home there, running in the New England ultra running community. So very similar but diverse groups. And when Josh and I started to talk about the trying to preserve culture and teach and using the Trail Animals Trail series as a vehicle, we had to sort of define, well, what's the objective? And it isn't just to put more races into the system. It really has an ulterior motive. So talk a little bit about what those were. And, you know, approachability was one of the very first things that we came up with. What does that mean? Well, it means, you know, we're in New England. We don't have the ability to run in great conditions all year round. It's pretty tough in the winter. And so in urban settings, you got to drive a ways, and you're driving into some nasty weather if you want to, you know, go up into trails. So could we find trails in more urban settings that were approachable, and you could have training runs on the weekend, and they were pretty and beautiful and challenging, but not an all-day affair? Could we make the club very low budget, so that folks, we have a lot of students in Boston, of course, mm-hmm. and, you know, they don't have a lot of extra coin, and yet they want to get out and run. And so can we make sure that the prices of joining the club, which is free, and the races are really low? Some are free. Most are, you know, under, you know, 20, 30 bucks. I think our 100-miler this year is what is it, Josh? $60 for 100.
Which one's that? I may need to travel out there.
that's
got a place to stay.
Yeah, our TARC 100.
I would say it's cheaper to fly out there and run your race than to run some of the races out here.
Yeah. So you know, you gotta also have an environment where the folks that know what they're doing, the veterans, are willing to spend time with new people, both mentoring and teaching and helping. And you know, when you do a trail run, that's a training run. We have a kind of a part of the credo is no animal will be left behind. we've almost succeeded. There's been a few that we've lost.
There's a few still out there, yeah.
Yeah, a couple of critters that are still wandering in the woods. But for the most part, you know, it means breaking into smaller groups or different paces, or folks running ahead and then stopping at designated places to make sure no one gets lost. No, and if someone only wants to run an hour, then you loop back and make sure we get them safe to where they're going and so on. And then there's the attitude. So when we put the races together, we decided that rather than us loading people up with a lot of aid, we asked everybody to bring one item based upon their last name, something salty, something sugar, something, you know, maybe soda and, mm-hmm. and fruit. And we started that a number of years ago, very simple. And you end up with homemade goods. You end up with every possible bit of aid. It's not a huge imposition on folks. And then all the leftover food we give to the shelter. So it's a very simple concept. We try to not use as many cups and, you know, really get people to use their water bottles to try to reduce the trash. We try to ask everybody take a turn at volunteering so that, you know, the host forests and trails ask us back. So we leave it better than we found it. That's another credo. And then the only other thing we ask someone to bring to a race is their chair. And the reason we want them to bring a chair is that when they're done, they'll pull up a chair and whatever else they've got in their cooler, and sit down and hang out and bring on all the other people that are behind them.
Bob, you know, I hope that, that others in the trail community really heard that, because I think that could be really catch on nicely. Not only the other things that you said, but bring a chair. I mean, I never bring a chair, and I know I'd stay longer and hang out longer and talk more and socialize more if, because my legs are tired. I'm going to go look for a chair, and one happens to be behind my windshield. And so if I had a chair, it would be difficult for me to get out of it. And so I would hang around for a lot longer. So I like that. I think we should all bring chairs.
Well, we had our TARC Spring Classic last weekend, Josh, and I think over 300 runners.
Yep.
And it was a beautiful, you know, spring day. We were blessed with that in New England. But despite that, we had probably 80%+ of the participants stay. And we ran everything from a 10K to a 50K. So you had people finishing very early. And a number of, I think over 70% of those participants that day were first-time trail runners doing a first, you know, maybe it was their first trail run or first, you know, half marathon, first 50K. And, you know, it was hard for some of them. And so as they came through, as a 10K loop, as they came through, there were all these people at the finish, start-finish area, as they looped through. And cheering them on. And we had a number of members shoot a note to us this week saying, you know, I wasn't going to go back out. I didn't think I could do another loop. I was ready to quit. But I was so lifted, you know, by everyone cheering and encouraging me and helping me, not just at the start finish, but along the trail, you know, folks trip and fall, or they're, you know, maybe they're bonking, so yeah. Folks will stop. And that's another thing that we when we do the trail briefing, we ask, of course, not to litter and, you know, the obvious things, but we also say, look, if someone is in need, it's imperative that you stop. You know, it really is imperative that you understand that this is about the community first, and about whatever you're going to achieve, you will finish. You will accomplish your goal. But it's really important that if one of our members is suffering, you know, you lend them a hand. And believe us, the karma you get out of that is tenfold, whatever 10 seconds or a minute or two that you're going to lose.
I keep monopolizing. I keep on raising my hand, and Don looks at me. You want to talk again?
Because I already raised my hand. Go ahead, Scott.
No, just along that point, I think, you know, part of the trail culture is that you stop and help, and that's one of the unwritten tribal culture items that we learn as we get into the sport, and I think that's a great point that maybe we need to remind people at these races that needs to happen.
Well, you know, I'm just going to go ahead and jump in, Scott. I'm not even going to ask you.
I'm just,
because I don't think we have to remind people. I think people do it because it's dangerous out there. And I think, you know, back to Josh's playing tennis, you know, everyone could finish a tennis game. You know what I mean? That probably, unless you get hit in the head with a racket, if you're playing doubles or a ball between the eyes, you're probably going to make it through that match.
There's some long matches.
You're going to make it through the match. It's anybody's bet out there in the trail. Things can happen. I mean, there's some snakes and cougars and just things, and that people can wander off the trail and get lost. You can be a hot day. You can be so low on fluids and just mismanage yourself. I mean, there's things that can happen. And because of that, I think we're drawn closer to one another. And some of those same things that are in our DNA and hardwired in, take care of one another, I think just comes out naturally. And we get closer to our real selves when we're out there with Mother Nature and in harm's way. And then we see a fellow runner with similar goals and aspirations. And we're like, dude, you need some help? I mean, I'll help you. And hopefully, like you're saying, Scott, is that we put the people, and Bob, you said, put the people before the bib number, right? People before the clock.
That's profound.
People before the clock. People before
the
clock.
The bib number was
bib
better.
Number?
That,
all right.
That's a bumper sticker right there. People before the bib.
And there are very few people that will understand, what the heck are you talking about?
Well, you know, Annette provides, tell a brief story that is consistent with this. So at Hard Rock last year, I had the privilege of a great crew, and one of the members of
Bob, may I interrupt and have you tell people about Hard Rock? Because not everyone knows what this is about.
Yeah, so Hard Rock is a 100-miler run in July in the southwestern part of Colorado, the San Juan Mountains. Average altitude is, I think, 11,500 feet. So it runs, you know, up to 14-plus, and it has about 33,000 feet of climbing, 33,000 feet of descent. So it's a you know,
it's hard. And it's rocky. What's the cutoff time on that run?
It's 48 hours.
48 hours for to get through that run. We see a lot of them that are 30.
Did we mention it's a 100-mile race?
Yeah, in rocks. And you have to orienteer a little bit. It's not marked with big glow sticks and people clapping and saying, over here, right?
Yeah, true. Yeah, it's
so you actually take a compass with you or a GPS?
It's advised, and I did, and I learned how to read a compass and make sure that I could navigate, because you can. It's more sparsely marked, would be a polite way of saying.
But it can get trampled by the livestock that are out there, right? I mean, there are little things in the ground that can get stepped on.
Those would be marmots, and they are. They love to eat the ribbons, and when they're done eating that, they'll start chewing on the markers, and yeah. So it is not at all inconceivable that you could get lost. You could wander off, and I think last year someone did indeed wander off and went missing for a better part of half a day. They had to scramble the helicopters. And,
wow.
So during that race, towards the end, my son, my younger son Drew, had the opportunity of having him join me as a pacer to finish the race. So we're coming down the last climb. It's 13,500 feet and, 15 or so miles to go. And we had just come out of a pretty bad thunderstorm right at the summit. So it's scary. And you want to get off that mountain because you are the tallest thing at the summit.
The summit.
Yeah. So we're heading down the hill, and we're into this now for me, 41 hours. So we're tired, and and it's a granite single track, sort of very dangerous precipice off to the left, and we're running pretty hard, and it's slick because it's pouring rain, and we just want to get off that hill, and I ultimately tripped over a granite rock and went down hard and started to go off the precipice, and Drew turned around, immediately grabbed me, pulled me back on, and we were following a couple, so a fella and his pacer, just in front of us. He heard me go down and immediately stopped. Now, you know, I have to put it in perspective. We're all out there 41-plus hour. We're all exhausted. We just want to get to the finish. It's pouring rain. It's dangerous. But this guy stopped the minute he heard me go down. Turned around. His pacer turned around. They all came back to me. I'm on the ground, and, you know, what can we do? How can I help?
Wow.
Looking in my eyes, I said, look, I appreciate it. I'm okay. I just need to kind of gather my thoughts, and my trekking stick had broken. I said, Al, I'll borrow Drew's. And he's like, no, I don't want to leave you. I just don't feel comfortable leaving you. I said, Drew's good. Drew, are you okay? Yep, okay. Finally convinced him. I said, look, you got to finish your race, but really, really appreciate the fact that you did this. So I'm gathering my thoughts, and down from behind us, coming down the hill, comes another runner and pacer. I'm prostrate across the trail, very narrow trail. The runner comes down from behind us and hops over me and runs on.
Wow.
And never stopped, never looked.
Pacer two?
Pacer two. And so we finished the race, and Drew and I were comparing notes about very exciting. But one of the things the thing that we walked away with, and my lesson to him about life and specifically this sport, is there you had it, Drew, in a little vignette, an incident. You had the good and the bad. You had the responsible, what I would term as the very much the culture of an ultra runner that would stop in any instance, particularly under those circumstances, and sacrifice you know, their own time. You know, there's a number of things that that runner was doing to sacrifice for me. And then you had someone else that was only focused on themselves. You know, there it is, black and white, yin and yang, whatever you want to...
That's a story, that's a good, that's the modern-day Good Samaritan story.
It is, and it is a warning to the sport, which is to say, look, if there's enough of the latter...
It will
runner,
change.
It will change, and it will not change for the better. So, you know, this is where you have to come back, and as we teach folks new to the sport about how to eat, how to run, you know, how to mentally prepare. I think adding to those conversations, these kinds of, you know, basic cultural, they're innate to most of us, as you said, Don. I think, you know, it's not that we have to be taught. I think we just, from time to time, have to be reminded of these things that really preserve underneath it all what makes this sport so unique and so wonderful. At least, you know, personally speaking, it's what draws me back to it all the time.
So Josh, here's a question for you. How do you, I mean, you and Bob have come up with this great series, trail running series and great trail running organization. How do you feel is the best way to educate these people about what we believe in or what our culture is? I mean, Bob is, I've known Bob now for how long?
How long have we been doing this?
Hour and 8 minutes. We're going 100 minutes. It's 100 podcasts. I didn't let you guys in on that. We're going to have to grab another topic quick.
But my point is Bob would never, at the end of this race, go and thump that guy that jumped over him against, you know, against the head and say, hey, we don't do that in this sport. That's, first of all, that's not who we are. But how do you find, Josh, the best way to communicate those little things about our sport to the new people that join your club?
How do we preserve culture
right. In
four words, Scott?
Okay. Well, how many words did I use? 20?
45. Oh, you're trying to get all 100 minutes in your question.
I get four words to answer this?
No. I just paraphrased his question in four words. How do we preserve culture?
I think, you know, the another bumper sticker, I think, like Bob was saying, one of the things, and because I feel like we reach most of our runners through this trail series, we get a lot of people new to trail running, new to ultras, and I think, you know, another bumper sticker is bring a chair, you know, so we sort of teach that way by example. And, you know, I know a lot of the people who finish, they hang out and they cheer people on, like Bob was saying. I think, you know, we've tried to really encourage people to, and one thing actually by organizing these races, I've really come to enjoy, it's a true labor of love is the behind the scenes. It's much more pleasant to be at an ultra behind the scenes than actually like suffering the pain of running. You know, you're there and you're sharing that energy, that positive vibe, and just encouraging other people. So trying to encourage folks to give back. And again, you know, I think even little things like having it be a semi fat ass where people bring food. You know, Bob wrangled me into Facebook a few months ago, and it's pretty incredible to see now that I watch this. I watch the TARC website as we gear up to these races, and people are posting, hey, I'm gonna be bringing these chocolate covered caramel Oreos and this and that, and someone else is like, oh, I'm bringing my gluten free vegan something or others, and they get really excited about
the caramel
sharing.
Sounds better to me.
Yeah, I mean the Oreos did look delicious. I will say the gluten-free vegan things were really delicious as well. But they get really excited about sharing these parts of themselves. And so, you know, ostensibly running, competing is something that we do individually, but I feel like we have to make these sort of strides to help people recognize that it really isn't about you individually. It's about us collectively. And if that's, you know, everyone brings a little bit of food for the aid station, if that's everyone brings a chair and cheers people on, you know, that's what we do. And if it's, you know, and we the people who this sort of communal tribal culture is important to, you know, I feel like it is our sort of responsibility to set the example. You know, if there's a person who's down, to stop and say, hey, I'm gonna help you. And so, you know, set the example when we're on the trail and encourage people to do the same. And, you know, I feel like that it's better to do than to say, basically.
Hey, Josh, I want to go back to your bumper sticker. Number one, I think I could find your car at a race because it would be filled with bumper stickers on the back because you're a big bumper sticker guy. But
I have none, actually. My mother-in-law's car has a bunch of stickers my kids put on it, though.
Oh, good. I know why they put them on there. They're listening to you. So you know, this whole thing about bringing in the chair, I'm going back to my chair for the third time now because it's the smaller communities. If a guy has a radiator that's blowing steam or a flat tire and it's a small town, you're going to stop and see and help because there's a chance you might know him. And there's a chance that you might know somebody that he or she knows, and you want to help them. In the big city, it's like you might stop to look to say, I'm glad it's not me, and, you know, hit the accelerator and blow a little smog on them as you're getting by and maybe cursing, saying, man, I'm late for work again thanks to this guy. I can't figure out how to change his tires. So as our community grows, the only way we can really protect is get to know one another. And you don't get to know your community unless you sit down and talk to them. You can run across them along the trail and greet them and say hello, but it's not the same as, one, running with them, and two, sitting down after a hard day's work and talking to them, or volunteering at an aid station.
Exactly. You know, one of the things that I was always impressed, one of the things that I was always impressed with when I ran with Jeff, one of Don and my friends, is if we ran across somebody, of course, he's an outgoing guy, which I'm not, he would run across somebody and he'd stop. You know, you're getting ready to pass somebody, go in the opposite direction. He'd stop and he'd go, hey, what are you training for?
Jeff was always looking at somebody to talk to. He didn't want to keep running.
and he would stop and he'd start up a conversation. And I didn't know anybody at the time. And he'd say, hey, by the way, this is Mike Savage. He does this, and this.
Right.
And this person is this person. And
John Nichols, et cetera.
John Nichols. Yeah, all the guys. You know, and he would introduce me. But the point was is, he was as interested as that on that person on a training run, you know, who are they and what are they doing? And, you know, that was the way that he got to know people.
Now, Josh, we don't have bumper stickers out here. I mean, we do, but what we hear in our community, yes, we do have a bumper sticker on our soundboard here, which has written on it, run like a trail animal. trailanimals.com, and that is a cool logo on it, and go check out trailanimals.com and take a look at this. It's not on the back of Josh's car, but it is on his mother-in-law's car, has two or three of them on there. Now we at Trail Runner Nation, that's what we use the PEK for, the Performance Enhancing Cocopelli. It is a temporary tattoo that we place on. It has really grown to be placed on the right calf facing forward, race direction. And it's a way that we can identify one another and establish our community. And it's, I think, part of what we have as a group.
It stands for the tribal culture.
The tribal culture.
There we go.
So,
you know, I want to... this is... I remember what I was going to say.
Oh, good.
I was going to say, I'm going to throw out a challenge to all the people that listen to Trail Runner Nation and have blogs. Or other types of social media,
so
whether they're Facebookers or Twitters or bloggers or whatever, I want to challenge everybody to write something after you listen to this podcast about trail culture.
Trail culture. Either a tweet or it doesn't have to be. We don't have to start a blog, right?
No. We don't know how to do that,
right? Because you might be asking a little much.
But to write about trail culture. And if you want to, you could send it to us, and we'll link it. And it'd be kind of neat to start this grassroots effort of people talking about how they feel our culture is, or what they
enjoy about this culture.
Okay, well, you, Mr. Electronic guy, social media world person, I suggest people might also just talk about it on the trail. Bring up the topic.
Oh, absolutely.
Use words, form with mouth, lips, air, make sounds. Oh. And communicate.
I have to deal with this all the time.
Wow. You guys need a room?
No. No, we fight in the public.
Jeez.
I'm just saying, you know, we need to talk about it too and not just hide behind the glass screen.
Okay, so let me rephrase that. Yes. Just edit that part out.
No editing.
And this is the real challenge.
Okay.
The real challenge is on your next run,
mm-hmm.
take somebody with you
yeah.
and talk about trail culture.
Nice. I like that.
And take your chair with you.
And bring a chair, yeah, exactly.
Bring a chair to the race. Now we're talking. Where are you going today? I'm going to a race.
And you're going to need your car because you got to put a bumper sticker on it.
That's right.
Bring that too.
And it's not about the bib.
What is it about?
Isn't that
Scott?
The other bumper
it's
sticker?
Not
we're
about
do?
The bib.
It's oh. not about the bib. Ooh. There you go.
No, I didn't invent that. That was you. We talked about
no,
that.
I'm copywriting sticker. That. Right
that was
there.
Much better. That's, no, I said time
you're
clock
get
bib.
Probably sued over there.
It's not about the bib. No, about
it won't the, be the first time.
It'd be a good movie title.
So we preserve trail culture by caring for one another and by getting to know one another. And that's probably the safest way. Do you see, Bob, I wanted to ask this question earlier on, but I couldn't get a word in edgewise with Scott. Do you see us approaching any, are we redlining, are we dangerous? How far along are we to what happened with the triathlon or with mountain biking? Are we at risk now?
Well, it's a great question. Oh, you guys. I think that, let's look at the demographics. So you have folks in their 50s and 60s that mm-hmm. and 70s that were essentially there in the United States, at least, at the quote-unquote beginning of what we can call ultra running. And a number of those folks have stopped running. They're, you know, either because physically they can't anymore or they've, gone to the communities where there isn't ultra running or disinterest. Many of them are involved in different ways now other than running. And so, but it's a diminishing number. And so, just like any good tribal environment, if it's not handed down, if the fundamentals aren't there and handed to the next generation, then you run the risk of losing the culture. So, you know, one of the things Josh and I talked about is this huge spike. I mean, if we look at our club alone, where we went from, you know, less than 100, really 20 or 30 in 2007, 2008. Here we are, over 2,500 members, 5 years later. So that's a tremendous spike. And We've got to do everything we can to get under the bell curve, if you will, where the majority of people are. And we've surveyed, you know, our membership, and we have a pretty good idea of the split of men and women and their age and kind of background and education. And in fact, somebody started a thread a few weeks ago, just curious, what does everybody do? And it was, what did it have, Josh? It had 200 responses. Everybody just I'm a doctor, I'm a physical therapist, I'm an architect, I'm a teacher. It was amazing.
And we could find this on your website at trailanimals.com?
Facebook.
At Facebook?
It was fascinating. And my point is that, so what we want to do is try to make sure that as many folks understand, you know, what are the basics of the culture. And practice them first and foremost, to both your point, and then turn around and say, this is, you know, if somebody new comes in and it's a friend, this is kind of what we do. So we talk all the time about how do you run and what gear do you need and how do you, you know, have nutrition and what's the right, you know, plan, and mentally, you know, more recently, you know, how do you prepare? But you just, you know, we don't talk a lot about kind of not how do you behave, but what are the things about the sport when people come in and go, wow, it's so different. And we hear it all the time from members go, I don't know what it is, but you know, this feels more like a family. We had a lot of comments about last weekend's race. It's more like a crazy family reunion than it is a race. Mm-hmm. And why is that? And you know, it's innate. And what we want to do is kind of pull out and say, well, let's tell you why it is. I mean, that's not by accident. We are trying to very much pull those components forward and make sure that we teach them, we practice them, and that way you carry them on so that as folks that may have been there at the beginning of the sport retire, if you will, from the sport, there's a whole new generation that comes up and goes, I got it.
Mm-hmm.
I got it. And, you know, I want to teach it. And I want to pass it on so that we can continue to keep this legacy going. And I think if we can break what happened in prior sports by getting ahead of it, mm-hmm. and understanding it and having enough leadership, and podcasts like this are wonderful because it can spread the news so quickly around the world, then there's a darn good chance that that culture will persevere for many, many, many decades. And the sport, as a result, will remain unique, remain enriching for people for many years to come and generations to come. And at the end of the day, you know, if there's one thing that I think Josh and I, even in our differences of age and obviously skills, have that in common, is we'd love to see our kids and our grandkids and our grandkids, great-grandkids, if they chose to participate in the sport, come back and say, hey, you know, I just did this trail run for the first time, and wow, it was great. What was great about it? Well, you know, the people were so friendly, and they were so welcoming, and it just felt like home. And, mm-hmm. you know, wouldn't that be great? I mean, it's very Pollyanna, and it sounds, you know, kind of religious almost. But at the end of the day, all we have is our legacy. And yeah. if that's something we can help contribute to, then that's a good feeling.
I liked your point about the veterans needing to stick around. And I'll cite Stan Jensen of run100s.com. I see him out at every race. He's either working an aid station, directing traffic, making sure people are busy helping and volunteering. I mean, he's just a great, great guy out there on the trail. And he's had his day where he was competitive out there running. And I mean, he's Stan Jensen. And now he's still there in the community. And he's making sure that what he loved about that sport sticks around. And I think that's one reason he's there. He likes the energy that's there. But I also think he wants to make sure that what he experienced is still there for the rest of us. So...
And to that point too, you know, for the TARC 100, there's this guy, local legend around here, Richard Busa. You know, the guy was born, I think he's in his 80s now, and you know, countless marathons and ultra finishes, and you know, he's volunteering for the duration of the TARC 100. You know, he's out there, he's preaching it, you know, and he's going to be out there making sure runners get the job done at the first 100 miler here. So, I mean, it's pretty incredible to see. It's inspiring to me, I know.
And you look at there are people that love the culture that aren't even runners. And you can cite this with some aid stations at, say, Western States, for instance, or aid station captains. They're not runners, but they love the community and they love what happens around it. So we have folks within the culture that aren't necessarily strapping on shoes. So it's bigger than just the trail, which is pretty cool too.
A bumper sticker should be made to say that.
It's bigger than the trail?
Yeah. You're going to need a bigger vehicle.
You wait, your chair's bigger than the trail?
My behind's bigger than the trail if I don't get back out there and start running. Well, Trail Runner Nation members, I think trail culture is the topic of the, let's call this, what is this month, May? May is Trail Culture Month, officially.
Wow.
Starting here. You can talk about it in a chair. You can tweet about it at We Are Nation. Ooh, look at that segue, Scott Warr.
You didn't hesitate when you said that.
You can go at Facebook.com, We Are Nation. No, what do we have on Facebook, Scott?
Trail Runner Nation.
Trail Runner Nation.
Yeah.
That's clever. I'm glad we chose that, right?
Yeah,
for convenience
and
ease.
Who thought of We Are Nation?
That was good. That was Tim. That was a ninja. And so we'd like to thank Bob, who has a great perspective, Josh, who has his perspective back in Boston and is fast. And as you notice, we're not as fast as Josh, but we could all share in similar topic, you know, and that's what's cool
about
this community.
That's part of the culture.
Right. A fast guy, guys that aren't fast, and, you know, all kinds of experience, but we can all sit down and just have a good conversation.
Well, and I will say this too, that
that's something you could actually go out. I mean, Don and I train together, and he's way faster than I am. But he will go out and run the same speed of me as I do on training runs.
He does it. I'm not any faster than you are, Scott. I just tell you that I am.
You're way faster.
Yeah, you're way faster than me too. You almost killed me in the AR-50.
Oh, come on. You have a finish time. I was done at 27. I took the car up to the finish to work.
More important things to do.
No, more important. But it's easy to run fast when I only had to go 27 miles and you had to finish the race. I knew I was burying you. No, that's not true. That's not true. So you like the Hoka, Bob? Yeah.
Yeah. You're coming up the Hoka. We're done with the podcast, and you have to bring up another topic.
Well, I'm going for 100 minutes.
What, do you have a new sponsor here?
No, but you run in the Hoka. You know, that's part of the trail knowledge, right? You enjoy the Hoka, and you find it helps you.
I enjoy the Hoka.
I there's time I like the Hoka, too.
You've run in the Hoka.
Here's what I've heard about the Hoka. Are you a full-time Hoka 100% of the time?
No.
Okay.
Neither am I.
And that's what I'm collecting about this Hoka. I'm collecting there's a time and a place. It's nice to put them in occasionally. In the rotation. Yeah. That's what I'm hearing from the Hoka wearers.
Except for Lee.
Well, Lee's a different animal. Lee McKinley.
Yeah. I think it's a great shoe. Mm-hmm. And if you can get over the geriatric comments, which every weekend.
You get those?
Oh, every single weekend. I happen to deserve them. But
Do you see as many Hokas on the East Coast as you do on the West Coast?
Josh, I don't think so.
Josh, you wear the Hoka?
I do not. He's I do not wear the Hoka.
He's okay. Minimalist.
Oh, yeah. You're a minimalist guy. Yeah. Okay. That's probably why he's so fast.
You know, one reason we're lucky out here, besides many, but we have a pretty large trail community. And what about other parts of the country? And I'm naive about this point. Are there areas that they just don't have the same community group size? Maybe you're the only trail runner in town. What then?
It's a good question. You know, and it's something that we did study kind of the demographics, where the pockets are, and you've spoken to them before. You know, the Northwest is a pocket.
Colorado.
Virginia, you know, Happy Trails Running Club, huge club there. We have a number of clubs in New England, Trail Monsters, and there's a big trail running group out in Western Mass, and Schnipsket down in, I never pronounce it correctly.
Texas has a big
community. I don't think anyone can.
Yeah, right. But they have really cool yellow outfits that you can't miss, and a great group in Connecticut. And so, but I think that it obviously just takes, when we studied lacrosse, and we were investors in a lacrosse equipment company, and we noticed that lacrosse grew from the East Coast, of course. It was more of an Ivy League prep school sport back in the earlier days, and then it began to grow. And of course, pockets in Long Island and Baltimore, infamous areas, upstate New York, and now it's gone nationwide, and it's really, really gone worldwide. And we looked at how that grew, and we found, for instance, that someone, say, graduated from Dartmouth and played lacrosse. Maybe it was club lacrosse, maybe the team, and they're now a dad. And they're living in
Granite Bay.
And they say, you know, I want to go out and play catch with my son or daughter, but I want to play lacrosse catch, not baseball catch. And they start to look around and go, well, who else can we play catch with? And they find one or two other people. And next thing you know, they're saying, you know, why don't we
start a club.
And get one team and another team, and we'll just start playing each other. And one thing leads to another, and there's this sort of, it's like sonar, you know, from that epicenter grows. And we saw that over and over and over again nationwide. I suspect ultra running, given the preponderance of races now, has the same effect. We're all it takes, you know, all it's, again, religious, all it takes is two to meet,
mm-hmm.
right? And those two can begin to build the culture and attract others. And if they can get the word out, and it's so much easier now than it was, 20 years ago, I would suspect that you're going to see pockets all over the world of people that share that common theme. And now that you have blogs and you have podcasts like this, they can connect on a nationwide, worldwide basis, and then go back and talk about it and share it locally. And I think that is a, you asked me earlier what's changed. That one comes to mind is a huge change. You know, with media the way it is today and the internet and the ability to get the word out about everything, that's a huge change. And of course, culture and opportunities like this to make sure that everybody appreciates that, it becomes very pervasive very quickly. So my hope would be that you have all these pockets of folks, and they begin to understand, you know, the bigger community they're part of, and you know, in that community, they begin to share with others as they come in, and it's a kind of an unspoken set of mores, and it's preserved, and that's really, you know, how cultures that have been pervasive through the years in history, that's how it works, and.
So as a society, have you noticed that more people understand when you say back in 89 or 88, when you started running the trails, and you say, I'm going to go on a trail run, and now today when you say, I'm going to go on a trail run, did people before scratch their heads and say, trail run, what are you talking about? Is there a better awareness of what's going on?
Oh, I don't know the answer, you know, from a, you know, analytical standpoint, but I would have... Certainly, my own anecdote is that, yeah, I think when I first started trail running in the 90s, that was, you know, people would kind of raise their eyebrow and go, really, you run on trails? And then if you talked about the distances you were running, then you got the, wow, you know, I get tired when I drive 100 miles, you know, that old thing. But now I think it's the first thing you hear is, oh, I read that book,
Born to Run,
you know, is that what you do? And then it, inevitably it's, do you do that crazy race out there in the desert? You know, that's become the general community, awareness is, yep, the book. And then there's that race in the desert. Have you done that one?
Or how about when they ask you, what's your pace? And you know, if you're having a great day, you might be a 14-minute mile pace, right, on a 100-mile run. Mm-hmm. And you say, well, you know, I'm 14-minute pace, 13. Well, except for you, Josh, okay? I mean, we're talking about this day.
That's when Bob drops the hard rock on top of their head.
Yeah. and then they think to themselves, heck, I ran a
5K.
Yeah, an 8-minute mile just the other day. It wasn't that bad. There's a big difference.
Yeah. I think that helps with the curiosity of someone. It all just really starts with, come out on the trail. It's different, you know, and one of the comments that we had over and over again from first timers last weekend at our spring classic, one walk up to us, Josh and I, and said, you know, I just finished the half marathon, and I've been having this debate with my colleague over here that it wasn't a half marathon distance, that the course is short. And Josh, you remember this? And
yeah.
And we said, no, it's believe us, it's over and over again. It is a real 13.1 mile course. But you got to understand, on trails, generally, the miles just go by quicker. Mm-hmm. And you're probably just experiencing the fact that, you know, kind of before you knew it, you were done. Because there's so many, you know, you're so many other things going on around you, and it's so, you know, lots of people to talk to and beautiful scenery, and you got to kind of always be paying attention, because in New England there's rocks and roots and swamps and mucks and streams and things that jump out at you. And she said, well good, I knew it, and kind of went back to her colleague and said, nah, you know, I just had a PR on the trails for a half marathon, and it's real. And I think that experience is repeated over and over again, where people say, yeah, you know, I go out and run 2 hours, 3 hours on the trails, and it just doesn't beat me up. It just doesn't feel like I've been out there that long. Why? Because, you know, an hour is an hour is an hour. But what is it about the trails that makes time go by? If you can get people to try it, that generally is one of the reactions they have. And you know, one thing leads to another, and they get into the community, and next thing you know, they've got 20, 30, 40 friends that they didn't have before.
Now, I know you guys are experienced race directors, and I don't want to get in the middle of your business, but when a lady or a gentleman comes up to me, if I were a race director in my imaginary world, and they said, I don't think the course is long enough, I would just simply say, you must be cutting the course, and I'm going to have to take that finisher's jacket, I'm going to have to take that medal away from you, and ask next time you just pay a little more attention. That's how you handle those folks, Bob.
Well, there's two problems with that.
What's that?
Well, at Trail Animals, we don't do medals.
Oh.
and what was the other thing?
Oh, finisher's jacket?
Yeah, we don't have. We will have a finisher's jacket for our 100-miler.
For the 100, yeah.
It's the first 100-miler, by the way, in the history of Massachusetts. And we're very excited to, and it's really, we have 200-milers in our club. We have a Ghost Train 100, which is also... I think that one's only $40-$45. Steve Latour is the race director, so we have two certainly of the more reasonable price. Mm-hmm. But there's only three kind of official Trail 100s in all of New England, if you can believe it. Of course, the Vermont 100 being by far the most famous. But so in all three of them share the same spirit. Vermont's much more established, of course, and goes back to one of the originals and was one of the has always been part of the Grand Slam. Mm-hmm. But you know the spirit there in Vermont is and Zeke Zucker is a member of our club and the race director there, and he's was there last weekend, and we talk about it, and it is this unspoken, kind of shrug your shoulders and go, well, yeah, I mean, this is what we do, and we hope others enjoy it. And if they do, well, two things, come back and spread the news.
Well, go out and check them out at trailanimals.com. Look at the races, look at the race series, check out the culture, bring your chair.
This time we're really ending the podcast.
Yeah, this is
the first time was like a false summit, right?
Were you
going up the hill and you think you're at the top and you go, oh, crap.
And anybody that wants to have a shorter race, if you're a race director, I'm not going to complain because I'm usually pretty tired the last few miles. So I'm just fine if you want to cut that thing short. If it's a 50-mile race and I'm smelling the finish line and I'm looking at 46 miles on my watch on my GPS, I'm thinking, oh, another good day. Now go out and run. Mas. I take you home, baby, let you keep me company. You give me some of you, I give you some of me. You look good, baby, must taste heavenly. I'm pretty sure that you got your own recipe. So pick it up, yeah, like you. I just can't get enough, I gotta drive through. Cause it's me, you, you, me, me, you. All night, have it your way. For play, before I feed your appetite. Let me get my ticket, baby, let me get in line. I can tell the way you